The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now and on video, Paul Hill, full-time analyst, equity investor, everything. He's the full nine yards. Looking very bright as well there, Paul, in your studio. Check it out in the video there. It's almost like you're in heaven.
Well, I wish the stock market was.
I was going to say the stock market's in hell.
Exactly. It's been a brutal week, hasn't it? I mean, I think a lot of sort of private investors have held this sort of the mega cap FANG stocks, and that's really sort of like seeing a huge disparity in share price performance. We've had the cloud boys doing really well, like Amazon last night, Microsoft and Google. But then equally on the other side of the engine, we've had PayPal, Meta or Facebook, we've had Spotify, we've had Zoom, we've had a whole bunch of other sort of like companies who haven't got this cloud sort of like comfort blanket, and they've just been absolutely wellied. So, I think portfolios are sort of like seeing quite a lot of red ink, and I know, you know, how's yours doing so far
dreadful.
This year?
I think it's my stocks are in a bear market, I think. I just genuinely think the in market's in a bear market. It's all been squeezed. I saw that drop in the Facebook. I was into Tenerife for my parents. I had Bloomberg on, and I saw that drop at 20-odd%, and that's 23%, 230 billion wiped off. That's the kind of, you know, that kind of volatility is what you see in small caps. It's phenomenal.
Yeah,
and at the moment, I just think it's very hard. I don't know. I've not known a time like this where it's been this hard for so long. It's like the liquidity being sucked out. I know microcaps tend to suffer first and they rally first as well, because the liquidity just sucks them dry. But it's been very hard. And I you know, every day switch on. If I'm lucky, if I get one stock in the green, it's like, what's going on here? And it's almost been squeezed from both ends. I mean, you've got some liquidity coming out in the market, and you've got, costs going up, inflation going up, Bank of England putting, rates up now. So it's thinking, how long does this cycle last for? Because it seems a lack of liquidity for a long time. It just really grinds you down, doesn't it, after a while? Even when we had bad times in the markets, you have a couple of stocks doing well, but at the moment, none of them seem to be doing well. It's really hard.
And also the other phenomena, actually, I know we've touched on it before, but really are seeing it more across the whole market, is that we're seeing the effects of social media, because it used to be when people sort of like used to read the paper, then they'd discuss a potential share, but you wouldn't see excessive moves very quickly. Now, what's happening is that everybody moves from one side of the boat to the other. So, for instance, this week we've had PayPal and Meta or Facebook obviously reporting fairly negative guidance, but not horrendous guidance for 2022. But suddenly, you've had sort of like all the bulls turning to all bears, and they're just posting on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. And that's sort of like have a huge shift that goes from one side to the next. And, at the moment, you just cannot find a single positive word to say about those stocks. And you've seen that with a number of others. I mean, I'll give you a case in point. One of the stocks that I own, Purple Bricks, for instance, which is obviously a controversial stock, but is still the UK's number one online or digital real estate or estate agent, etc. Came out with half-year results this week. And frankly, the boat is definitely, or should we say, the ship is definitely turning there. I mean, the CEO, and I've spoken to him, Vic Dani, he's doing a great job. He's put in all the right measures, improvements in place, like he's converting from self-employed model to a fully employed. And the idea is that you're going to get a far more consistent tech-enabled customer experience that is going to be localized to the regions, i.e. you know, it gives them the sellers there, you know, the information that they actually need is going to be scalable, and you know, it's going to, you know, win them more selling instructions. So he's doing all the right things. And the comments he was making were reasonably positive. And the shares actually have gone, you know, slightly down on the results. And the other good bit of news they had, which was a bit of an own goal in the past, they had this, it was really a technical, it seems an alleged technical breach in not sending out letters to renters for their leasing or their rental business. And they put a provisional figure of roughly between 2 to 9 million. It came out at 3.6. But the Daily Telegraph had been banding around 30 million as a potential liability. And that just spooked. So it comes back to, i.e., you just can't, certainly for certain areas, or because of the sort of like the overlay of social media, all investors suddenly turn negative or suddenly turn positive, and you see really sharp movements. Now, the important bit for me and you, and for other people listening to this, opportunity, because you get huge moves that are totally disproportionate to the underlying value of the business. And that's when I can't come back to Purple Bricks. I'm underwater on my investment so far in Purple Bricks. I've lost a reasonable sort of six-figure number on them already. But frankly, the actual opportunity, I'm pretty confident that that effectively all the measures that the CEO and the management team are doing are going to work. I think these, and just to give you an indication of value or potential upside, if they can actually pull it off and increase their market share from roughly around about 4% currently to 10% over the next 5 years. And I think there's every way that they can do, because they are still disrupting and disintermediating the high street estate agents. If they can do that, then they'll hit sales of, I believe, around about 200 million in sort of 5 years' time on a 20% EBITDA margin, a minimum of 10 times EBITDA, and you get a share price of 80p. Now, in comparison, the City have got a price target of 75. So we're not out of totally, out of whack there. The shares are currently 20p. They've got 50 million of cash on their balance sheet of about 16p, per share. And anyway, at the moment, I think the risk reward profile for, let's be clear about it, you've got to be relatively risk averse or risk tolerant to go into it. And I am. And take a reasonably long-term time horizon. I think there's every chance you could make significant money on that one.
Yeah, but do you know what? You're right with the bearish theme and narrative. And like I said, commentators sort of play into this. So they chase the narrative and inflame it, because it creates clicks, likes, and retweets.
The media, the press are the same.
Yeah, exactly. But do you know what? I had a rare occurrence. When was this? I'll look at the date there. 26th of January. Escape Hunt, right? I don't know. XP Factory now came out with a trading update. Very decent. Now, taking into account, they've not been open for 5 months of the year, right? So they only release a trading update on their escape rooms. They now have Boom Battle Bars as well. But just the escape rooms, owner-operated, not franchisees, not remote, none of that, none of the online stuff. So they did 5.1 million revenue, which is 133% higher than 2019 comparative periods when they were open fully. So EBITDA, 2 million, positive. They had more cash than expected, ahead of expectations. Now, they're going to do about 25 million in revenue this year with Boom Battle Bars. Their EBITDA margins are about 25%. And yet it rose, but then a couple of days later, people start selling. Is there any bit of worry out there? People start selling it. People can't seem to hold on to the stock. There's a lot more trading going on. And that's encouraged, I think, by social media and all that. But people, any bit of worry, and they sell, because the more research people will hold. But generally, I think 90% of people just follow other people who do research, pretty much. And if they get any bearish, any bearish themes coming out or negativity, rather than just do some deep research themselves, they're just, I'm just going to sell this and get out. And that's the problem. People don't hold stocks. It's more about trading here. And I mean, when the markets start to turn, then obviously the money will inflow and it'll become that movement, the momentum will go upwards. But right now in a difficult market, people are not holding stocks. You've got a good business. I mean, as I said, look at the business, Is it improving? Will it be a lot better in a year's time, in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time? If it is, and the share price isn't reflecting that yet, that's an opportunity. But yet people are not thinking like that. They see a little bit of red, in their account. They start to sell. I don't hold on to a loss. I think we only lose if you sell. Like I say, think of it as a business. If it was your business and you're doing well and people were pricing it was wrong, you wouldn't sell the business, would you? You'd just carry on with it. So it is hard at the moment, and I think people are not holding on to the stocks. There's a lot of negativity there, and people are just scared, I think.
Well, I just think, unfortunately, social media is brilliant in the fact that it moves communication in terms of it allows people to have better views and all this sort of stuff. But also what it's done, and unfortunately, I see it in partly in my kids, actually, is that what you have is that you get basically, effectively, you know, people talking about a potential share or whatever like that. Mm. And then everybody else effectively defaults to that view. And you get sort of like an avalanche of buying or an avalanche of selling very, very quickly through social media. And as I say, that presents opportunity for people who are taking more of a long-term view. And another case in point exactly is Capebox. I mean, it had a negative, I would say, journalist report from a guy called Maynard Payton from ShareScope about, I don't know, 10 days ago, 7 days ago or something like that. The shares were trading at about nearly £4. They're currently being flattened to round about, was it £2.50 or £2.40 or something of that ilk, just on the back of this report. Because what happens is then it gets sort of sprayed around the internet. Yeah. Anybody who's remotely fearful sees it, sees the headlines, and then just hits the checkout button and just sells. And so you do get these enormous wild swings, which are totally disproportionate to the fundamentals of the business, particularly when the company responded to the actual report. That, I mean, most of the issues are just to do with historical balance sheet reporting, and frankly, are just not significant. I've had a look at it, just not significant at all. And the company, in their response, said they're actually trading really strongly anyway. They're cash generative and they're growing really well. So there's no, they had a good Christmas. And there's even that, the share price has been absolutely flattened. So that really shows opportunity to long-term investors prepared to look through the short-term headwinds. And it's just a sort of like, it's a trend of social media. It's unfortunately the double-edged sword. It's good when people informing people, but too many investors and too many of the general populace then sort of like just use it as their decision making process. They're not rational themselves. They don't think for themselves. They just rely on somebody else to do it for them. And so when you get this guy Maynard Payton, and frankly, I just think, you know, okay, he's a bright chap, no doubt about it. He's done some good work there, but he's drawn out largely historical issues that frankly are not significant for the intrinsic worth of the business. And it's just led to a huge avalanche of selling, totally disproportionate to the underlying strength of the business.
Yeah, well, that's it. I said, you know, most of my shares, I think all my shares are in a bear market, but this is not the time to sell. This is the time to buy. If businesses are like this, they're undervalued, it's the time to buy. You know, if you sell right now, you make, like I said, a lot of private investors don't make money. Why? Because they get fear, they get scared by the market, the emotions. They sell at lows, and then the market starts to rally, and they buy at a higher level than where they sold at. Now, that's the opposite way to make money. So, you know, when it's like this, if you've got spare cash and the businesses they're still improving and they're undervalued, maybe top up. Don't sell. This is the worst time to sell. You know, it's the best time to buy, the worst time to sell. But people do the opposite. So, there are plenty of opportunities out there. Any news happening, Paul, on stocks anyway?
Yeah, well, there's been plenty. I mean, there was a huge announcement yesterday from Avacta about its chemo warhead treatment, AVA 6000, which is going through phase one clinical trials at the moment. Just to recap, it started its phase one trials, I think it was August of last year in the Royal Marsden with first patient dosing. And the idea is the phase one trial is split into two phases. First is 1A, which basically just tests the safety and tolerability of the drug within patients with metastatic or advanced cancer, solid tumours, a small number. And then once you do that, you get a rubber stamp on the safety, you then move to phase 1B, which is, I think, starts sort of mid this year, goes for another 12 months. And that then looks at or tries to actually assess the best dosing regime, the maximum tolerated level for the patient in that 1B, to then be able to use that data for effectively the real sort of hard efficacy data in phase two. But they will get some efficacy data, some initial stuff in that 1B. So that's sort of the timeline for this phase one trial. Now, just to say, to recap, they started in August. They've had already some really good sort of, like, in my view, some initial data, et cetera. They haven't released it, but that's what, and the reason why I can get that sort of view is that the FDA has already approved a similar phase one trial out in the States to start later this year. In fact, I think it's fairly soon, the first half. They wouldn't be doing that unless the initial readout of the data was good, was already good, the safety and tolerability of it. And then also the other good news just recently is that they had, they've got another second lead candidate for the same precision platform for this sort of prode drug format. I think that starts phase one trials sometime next year. So they're making real good progress because the initial readout for this one is good. Anyway, the news yesterday, which was just fabulous, is that they've decided in this phase one ACE side that the safety data from the initial dosage level, which is about equivalent to the maximum dosage level for just doxorubicin, is fine for pro-doxorubicin, which is what their compound is, or effectively their pro-drug format. So that then means that they can then increase and escalate the level of dosage of the doxorubicin within the pro-drug by 50% to continue the actual trial as planned. So that is a really good sort of like rubber stamp of the safety profile and the tolerability of the actual prodrug, which says to me that actually that the precision platform is doing the first part of what it says it's doing. It's protecting the protecting the patient from having its health, having their harmful, their healthy cells from being damaged by doxorubicin, because it's an indiscriminate drug that hits both cancerous and healthy cells or healthy tissues. And so if it can actually tolerate the maximum dose from doxorubicin, that says that it's actually working on the safety side. The efficacy data will come later, and hopefully we'll get some PK data, which is it's basically the movement of the drug within the person's body relatively shortly as well. So, yeah, really good positive information coming out from that. And that's just one of their sort of like key therapeutic platforms. You've got the precision platform, which does this, as I say, it has been licensed and patented technology from Tufts University out in the States that is effectively a chemo treatment. And there's lots and lots. This is a multi-billion dollar market. And then you've also got the Affimer platform, which is essentially antibodies, but they're not antibodies. They're effectively their own format of antibodies they can use for diagnostics and for therapeutics. And that's the other side of the business that's got lots of sort of like agreements with other third parties to test it. So they've got lots of shots on goal here. The first one, really big major one, is going really well. And hope to hear some more good news over the next year, you know. So they seem to be really in the sort of the box seat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I'm looking at the company's charts here. All of them are having a tough time. The ones we mentioned so far. It'd be nice to see a chart that's going up to the top right there. But cool. Back there, what's next?
The other one. I mean, Lung Life came out that. They're basically doing a best-in-class diagnostic that allows the early detection of lung cancer for patients with sort of just stage one lung cancer. And the problem you get there is that the current best-in-class sort of like test they have is a CT scan. Mm-hmm. And you have, just to give you an indication, there's about 5 million people in the States who are diagnosed with indeterminate lung cancer nodules. They don't know whether those nodules, that effectively growths, are cancerous or a tumour, or alternatively just harmless. What 1.5 of those 5 million come out with indeterminate, whether it's cancerous or not, and therefore they're just faced with either going through a biopsy, which can be risky, or alternatively delaying any sort of treatment or just worrying. So the idea is that with this new test that Lung Life do, it's a blood draw based on CTCs, which is effectively, you know, leading edge technology. And it's got a predictive positive value for that test of 89%. Yeah. And anyway, it's started now. First, it's, you know, first patient is actually commenced on its validation study that will rubber stamp those initial tests. If it does that, and that is, it's going to take a year. It's about, I think it's 425 patients across a couple of centres out in the States, etc., then this is going to be just a best-in-class test. And this is, again, an absolutely enormous market. I mean, you know, if you run the actual numbers and they only get sort of 5% share of the US market, you can easily get, just on normal sort of market multiples and profit margins, of a share price of 20 quid and the shares are less than 2 quid. So there's huge upside. And this could really revolutionise, importantly, the detection, the early stage detection of lung cancer, just by a simple non-invasive blood draw, which is so much better than having to do a biopsy or having to wait. Because, I mean, most patients, if they get cancer, unfortunately only rock up in the hospital spitting out blood at stage four. Yeah. You can't even, you know, treat them. In fact, you'll only really be able to treat them with a Avacta's chemotherapy, you know, prodrug, which hopefully will, in a couple of years' time, will be there. So, yeah, I mean, they've come out with really good news. But again, the shares didn't move at all, you know. It, but that's, it's a good, you know, it's another major, major milestone that the company's reached when it came to do its IPO last year and its promise. So it's absolutely doing what it says it was going to do.
Yeah, it's almost like you put news out in this market, good news, and the share price, if you're lucky, stays where it is. Sometimes, yeah. Put good news out, and that's the liquidity people need to sell. They think, oh, no. So, but, it's just hard. It's a terrible hard market, very hard.
Mm.
What's next,
Father? Another one on the healthcare side, which is well, really on the OTC healthcare side, is Venture Life, and I interviewed the CEO earlier in the week, Jerry Randall, and they came out with you know, their trading update for the full year, and I mean, basically their second half of 2021 has made has been an absolute sea change. You saw sort of sales up 35%. Yes, some of it's is most of it's the acquisitions which they did, and they're doing really, really well of BBI Healthcare and Helsin. And they have, you know, just modest level of debt, etc. But their second half sales sequentially were up, I think it was 35% compared to the first half. But more importantly, the profitability, you saw that scale coming through. The profit margins just absolutely rocketed. So if we had 14% EBITDA margin in the first half, coming to 23% in the second half. And that really is a combination of mix and better gross margins and, you know, operating leverage. And if you run that just level of, you know, sort of like sales and margins into this year without much growth, sort of, you know, high single digits, sort of, you know, 10% growth, etc., which is what they're already doing. He's seeing that with his order book, etc. If you do that, then you already hit the analyst, you exceed at the EBITDA level the analyst expectations, and you hit the actual sales number of about 40, 41 million, etc. So this is, the business seems totally underpinned with what it did in the second half. And on top, it recently appointed a Chinese distributor for its mouthwash products, Samarkand. And the minimum sales there, he told me, is £1 million for this year. If you add that on top, you're gonna see a beat. So the business is in a really good position. The actual shares responded well, but they're still really cheap. I don't know what they are today. Probably around about, is it
45.9? Well, on that update, they went up 36% on the 31st of Jan, but as always, they went up to sort of 51 pence, and now they're drifting back down again. That's the market, isn't it?
What's quite interesting there, I think, the way I'm reading it, actually, is there's a lot of buyers out there. A lot of people are interested at these levels, because, I mean, just give you an indication, I mean, at 45p, I'd have to run the numbers, but the shares were trading at certainly less than 8x EBITDA, and these businesses go to sort of 15 to 20 times EBITDA. And there's a guy who's been following this for some time, and he's, you know, Simon Thompson, Investors Chronicle, he's got a price target of a pound. And I can easily see this worth more than 90p per share. So there's plenty of upsides. There's a lot of buyers who are actually interested at these levels because it's underpinned by the balance sheet and the products, et cetera, and the defensive nature of OCT, you know, healthcare, which is great. But the way I read it is actually there's an institution who's actually selling. They're not a disclosable position of more than 3%, but they're dropping stuff into the market. And that, again, just shows, it smells opportunity to me, because if you're interested in buying the shares, there's actually stock available. And if you've got a relatively long-term time horizon, you'd be able to pick up a decent position at these sort of current levels, hold on to them. And in a couple of years' time, you'll probably find it's certainly going to be north of sort of like, you know, 80p, and could well be over a quid quite easily, because that's where they were sort of like, you know, before the pandemic hit. So the business is doing pretty well.
It's interesting, the dynamic of markets like that, because you get people selling on just generally on bad news and pessimism. And then after a while, the selling dries up, you know, and any amount of buys, and you get start moving stocks nicely. And then you get some more positive narrative. And then the people on the sidelines who, you know, sold, start buying in, and generally a little bit higher than when they sold out, you know, so the money comes back in then. So it is like a tide, I suppose, isn't it? But where will this tide end? That's at the moment, it's going out. When will it come back in, you know? So it's hard
to say. But the point is, the business is doing well. That's the whole thing, is such that, you know, you get a couple of people who decide to sell or whatever, and it just takes the share price down. I mean, another one is a case.
It's amazing how many people are probably buying this a lot higher. And they're sold now. And they go, hang on, it's a better opportunity here at this level. Don't you understand valuations?
Yeah.
Go on. What's the next one?
Yeah, I mean, the other one, which is a similar sort of thing, which is knocking the ball out of the park, is Revolution Beauty. You know, Adam Minto and his team there, basically, which do as quality, affordable sort of cosmetics and hair care and skincare products, I mean, et cetera. I mean, they've just been, they had a Christmas trading update, and they saw, a year-on-year like-for-like jump in sales of 41%, you know, over November, December, which is just absolutely fabulous. And, you know, if you actually look at their partners, I mean, it's just a huge endorsement of their product range. You know, they've got Walgreens, Boots, Target, Ultra Beauty, etc. And I think the US is now probably their biggest market. That says to me, because they're increasing their store footprint within these particular, you know, major retailers, that says everything about the quality of the product and the brand, and particularly how it's resonating with end consumers who go into these stores and have a reason that they go there to those particular shops. And then they buy, obviously, the Revolution Beauty, but they'll buy other products as well. So it's really bringing new customers into those particular retail outlets. And if they get that demand pull in, they're going to continue to get more and more retail shelf space, or effectively display place in these. And the momentum is really good. I mean, okay, the shares went up again and has sort of settled off at about 125. But again, yeah, they're really cheap. I mean, if you run the numbers and you look at sort of like, you know, the house broker Zeus, what they've got and stuff, I mean, they've got a fair value of £2. And I think that's pretty modest anyway. So again, if you've got a sort of 3 to 5 year time horizon, there's a lot of gas in this, you know, in this business. I mean, if you think about it, 40% like-for-like growth over Christmas during sort of like, you know, lockdowns in its major market in the UK, et cetera. What would it have done if it didn't have any lockdowns? That is just fabulous. That's great, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So the point is, you've got is a brand that is really, really connecting with its end consumers and demographic. And the momentum is actually getting better and stronger for that. So
exactly. But another chart, you know, from IPO down, it's like there's so many opportunities here. And after a while, you know, they won't go ignored. You know, it will pick up. You can see that's the way it works. That's the way the market works. It's, people sell, they go down and get cheap. People buy, it goes back up. So, now's the time. If you've got cash, you've still got a bit of cash, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm ideally looking for I'm sort of like, there's so many opportunities out there, and I get sort of like, you know, asked about this so often on LinkedIn and social media and Twitter and stuff like that, is that, you know, why don't you own a stock that you like, Paul, you know? And I say to them, I can't own every single stock because you just end up with a huge jumbled mass portfolio that is really not going to meet your long-term financial, you know, objectives. And so, you know, I've got, I mean, for instance, you know, with like Revolution Beauty, I'd love to buy that, but I've actually got, you know, a fair selection, or I've got a fair position already in consumer stocks, you know, disruptive consumer stocks, purple bricks and with Boohoo, et cetera. So, you know, I'm already there. But the areas that I want to really beef up, and I'm being disciplined in doing that, is finding the right, you know, health, more healthcare, more tech, more software, which is where I want to play long, long term, with lots of IP, lots of pricing power in an inflationary environment. And I know I keep saying this, but that's where I'm sort of really concentrating. So yes, I like lots and lots of stocks, because I think there's masses of bargains out there. There's no doubt about it. But you cannot buy everything, because if you do, you don't meet what you don't effectively, your overall portfolio construction doesn't do what you want it to do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, go
on.
No, I see people are holding lots and lots of stocks. Now, if you own less stocks, there's more volatility, of course. But I mean, if you, for example, a very basic example, if you own 100 stocks and you get a 10 bagger there and they're all equally weighted, you've only got 1% in your portfolio. I mean, to me, that's not enough reward. Of course, there's more risk the less you have, but I want a bit more reward for that. And so, yeah, it's easy to start buying up good ideas every time I hear one, but it's a stage where a good mover in your portfolio will not do anything to your portfolio value. You know, you've got to have a certain amount, haven't you, you know?
Yeah, and also it becomes lopsided, because you have sectors which... You have sectors that sell off, for instance, like oil and gas did 2 years ago or 18 months ago. And then you suddenly load up on masses and masses of oil and gas, or alternatively, you know, consumer at the moment and stuff like that become really negative. You can just absolutely overload if you're not careful on one particular sector. And then your whole sector becomes... your whole portfolio becomes lopsided just on one particular area. And so you need to get that level of balance and diversification, cross-sectional, cross-regional, so it meets your, you know, your long-term time horizons and what you're actually, you know, looking for. Another one which I do own is Amrit Pharma, that came out with news like this earlier this week that it's sort of like breakthrough treatment for EB, which is that really severe skin condition. Last month, it got sort of deferred by the FDA for their decision point until the end of March. And then the EMA, which is the European equivalent, they've deferred it, I think, the FDA deferred it to the end of February. And the EMA have now deferred their decision from January to the end of March. So it's got 2 months and 3 months, you know, so respectively, of further delays. But it just says everything that these medical bodies are snowed under, trying to deal with sort of COVID vaccines, antivirals and testing and all this sort of stuff. And they're taking a really sort of like, you know, they're almost like a bit of a logjam of potential new treatments. Isn't really what they should be doing, simply because, you know, if you actually think about it, there's far more people currently in the world dying of cancer, heart disease, and all other, lots of the main problems than there are from COVID. But because it's such in people's sort of like, you know, in front and center, Then essentially it's getting disproportionate level of their resource and time. So anyway, it's just one. I mean, you've had the same thing with Polarian, haven't you? But
And I said, when I spoke to Richard, I got the impression that they're literally the FDA, you know, superbly overrun. You know, they've got so much going on. And even if you look, I remember a while back, I did look at the FDA website and applications there. And even just the phenomenal amount of applications, even just for testing kits, COVID testing. Just overrun with them, hundreds and hundreds of them. And thinking, wow, how do they get through that? Because they can't just take on staff, you know, be qualified in certain. It's not easy to just take on casual staff. They can't do that. So they aren't overrun, you know. But they were.
The other thing with the FDA, which is, you know, is that where they have actually approved sort of like drugs that are sort of like in inverted commas controversial, like the Biogen one for dementia. And treat Alzheimer's. They tick the box and let that one go, etc. With a relatively sort of like thin application label, effectively thin applications on the actual label that it can be used for. And they've got hugely vilified and criticised for it. So they could also, the other side of the coin is that now they could be thinking, actually, I'm going to take a really sort of like, you know, cautious view about sort of like approving drugs. Not that this new drug is unsafe. It's just the efficacy isn't as good as it doesn't appear to be quite as good. So, you know, you look at that sort of like, for multiple reasons, the FDA and the European health authorities are taking a slow boat up the Nile, aren't they, at the moment, when it comes to approving other drugs.
I tell you what, on every Wednesday, I do a weekly webinar with my sort of share pickers investment time. We go through sort of micro-cap investment ideas. Mm. And one of the guys piped up, I think, last week, in fact, before their last set of results, I think it was, mentioned he likes Roslyn Data. I think he got it from you.
And I said,
I like what they're doing, but it's one of these things, isn't it? It's going through transition. They're looking for growth, and it'll take a while. They're in the right area, but it won't turn around overnight. I think they came out literally the day after, I think we talked about it on the webinar. I think they came out with, was it a half-year report or trading statement or something like that?
And, it was half-year report, yeah. I mean, as you know, I own shares in it, et cetera. And
what's your thoughts there? What's happening?
Yeah, well, it's basically work in progress. I mean, I've been a holder for, what, 2-3 years or something like that. And, I mean, the shares haven't done very well. But they're very, very cheap. And they're certainly, you know, they're now going through sort of like an unbundling, a shareholder value unbundling process. So it looks as though they might well sell the customs import-export part of the business called Langdon Systems they acquired a couple of years back. They might also sell their integrity, that's unstructured data, over the next 3 to 6 months as well. Leaving them with their sort of best, well, it's a very good sort of big data supply chain AI management system called Rapid that is having a new upgrade, going to be released very shortly, probably certainly in the first quarter. And that's already had very good customer responses. And that will the main benefits there, it's more user friendly, but particularly scalable. It reduces the sort of the implementation periods that the customers need to do, and it gives them a lot more value. So they've got high hopes on that particular part of the business, and they've still got plenty of cash. So shareholders haven't got to worry about, you know, in that respect. But it's going to be generating organic growth going forward, and you've just got to give them a bit of time. And it's taken far too long. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't mean I'm certainly not selling. That's for sure. And I know when I spoke to their largest shareholder, Gresham House, a few months ago. What's the guy? Ken Wotton. He was very positive on the actual stock. So I think, you know, he's getting involved in the strategic positioning of that particular company, unlocking value.
If they can get
like for like growth for Rapid, then this will do very, very well. But you're probably looking at a timeline of sort of 12 months to 24 months for this one.
Yeah. And so a decent amount of cash, haven't they? Another loss making still 4.8 at the last thing. What are they valuing that at? 12 million and their market cap?
I mean, it's peanuts, basically. I mean, if you want to get in, probably the liquidity isn't brilliant anyway at the moment. But it's one of those things that I'm going to sit on and hold and wait until, you know, they give the management team a chance. And certainly there's some positive noises, but it's actually translating that into hard figures. And it looks like that classic sort of thing. A lot of hard work and excellent sort of like progress has been made under the surface that isn't currently reflected in the numbers. In fact, during this sort of like, you know, transition, they're going backwards. But give it the sort of like, you know, the next financial year, which I think starts in June or May or something like that, then you'll certainly should see a much better progression. At the moment they haven't really sort of like been able to get that. And they've been through a lot of disruption with management changes and stuff like that, which hasn't been great. But you can make as many excuses for as long as you like. At some point in time, the rubber's got to hit the road and you've got to start hitting the numbers out. And I think they will. But
the thing is, they know what they've got to do. That's the thing. It's, you know, when management are ploughing on and you think, well, you know, sales isn't growing. But they're still playing on. That's the issue. But they understand here. This new Paul Watts guy seems to understand. They know exactly where they should.
And they've won some good new customers, like, you know, big pharma contract, etc. So, you know, that's an excellent endorsement to the actual platform that it particularly works. Is it risk free? No, but at current levels, there's a lot of bad news already priced into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. All right. Anything else?
Another one on the healthcare that's absolutely flying is Bellascura, which does the portable oxygen concentrators, their leading one, and they came out with a sort of like a trading update, upgrading their expectations for this year, next year, etc. So, yeah, I mean, they've had really strong demand. I mean, this is, again, this is in the context that they only had a soft launch of the product, and they've gone through sort of like, you know, much higher demand from, you know, basically customers in the States, and also interest from overseas as well. So the direction of travel for Bellascura is definitely up, and the issue, well, not the issue, but, you know, the task, I think, is just going to be making enough of these devices and being able to then sort of like, you know, put them out to the distributors for them to sell them through. So the customer interest of them is really strong, and I think it will continue because this is a big growth market, and their product is just about best in class. So yeah, I mean,
first chart we've looked at today where it's literally been going in the right direction for investors.
Yeah, so, I know.
having said that, it's come off a little bit. It dropped by 8%. So it hit what, 150 odd, it's down to 114 now. So It has come off a little bit with everything else, but it's been starting to go in the right direction, hasn't it? You know.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I do the valuation, you know, you sort of like, you can easily come out at sort of like north of £1.80. I know the house broker, I think it's Dowgate Capital, have £1.50 as their price target. But, you know, there's plenty of gas still in that tank. I mean, you know, then they IPO'd middle of last year at 45p. So the shares have obviously done well, but it's best in class technology. And the product's well in demand, as you see it through the interest so far. Admittedly, early days, but as you say, if you take a long-term view, you could easily do very well on this stock.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else happening?
Have you got any sort of news on your portfolio?
I'm waiting for a couple of trading updates. I mean, there was one from where was it? Biome, which is decent. I mean, Biome's, you know, they most of their customers, they bioplastics, degradable plastics, of course, and they've got this other part, which is RF technologies, heat induction, and fiber optics sort of producer. And that was a business I wasn't even looking at. I was looking at the bioplastic. Yeah. But that's won three contracts, surprisingly, in the last 6 months worth of £1 million. But the cash level is high. They did a trading update. Market expectations of 5.6 million this year. It's supposed to be a lot higher than that. But they're expected to achieve, as long as, you know, supply chains allowing, about 47% growth this year in revenue, and heading towards profitability. But again, the market socky just didn't like it. So annoying. But again, that is, you know, what is it? It's market cap right now is 9.58 million. They're going to be doing 8.7 million in sales next year and pretty much break even. And so I'm thinking, it's not dear at all. So it's cheap. So it's annoying. I'm waiting for one for trading updates from Gfinity. Should be coming out soon. Apparently, that they're on their Gfinity Arena was on The Apprentice last night, which is quite nice. It's a documentary on BT Sports on esports, which is part of their thing.
Oh, okay.
Everything's treading water. I mean,
Have you got anything of sort of like in the crosshairs to buy or even to sell? No, I mean, you're sort of like
No, I just said, you know what? I don't think any of these, you know, stocks are anywhere near their potential. So, I mean, this may be just a dud 6 months, dud year, but in fact, it's been longer than that now. But so just got to wait it out. I mean, they're not achieved. I mean, the underlying businesses are growing. They're doing what I want them to do, but the share prices aren't reflecting that. But so, what's that? I don't want to sell. You know, I like them. I mean, they're in quite hot areas. So,
I see you've been writing quite a bit on green hydrogen as well just recently.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, whenever I invest in a company, you know, one of the filters are, you know, look for growth, look for valuation. I also wanted to be in quite a hot area that's going to be growing for the next, you know, 5-10 years, hopefully, not just a flash in a pan. And green hydrogen is one of those things. And, you know, there's questions of the viability of it because of the cost. But this has happened with everything, even from solar. You know, solar's come down by 90% in cost from 2010, I think, to 2019. And all it needs is investment. And investment is going in there from countries to companies. So it's huge. So I think green hydrogen is going to be massive. SGM, one of the gas network producers, are going to be mixing hydrogen soon. And I think they've got 23% is going to be hydrogen. So a lot of this green hydrogen can be used with, you know, the infrastructure there from gas networks. So, but yeah, the cost will come down because if you notice, all the big oil and gas guys are getting to it now as well. So, when they start...
Well, they have to, don't they? The shareholders are putting so much pressure on them.
Yeah. So I think it's a very hot area. But again, you know, they've had no news out recently, GTC, but hopefully they're going to get there. Just sit and wait. I mean, it's so frustrating to see the share prices drop, but I'm not going to sell if the business are not, if the business are getting worse, fair enough, but they're not. It's just the share prices are, which is very annoying. I wish I'd just been sitting on top of cash right now, but I haven't, and that's the only problem I've got, really. I wouldn't be as frustrated, like I said, if I had a lot of cash, could I just buy some more? But I haven't. So sitting there watching the SPs dwindle. But like I say, microcaps can move very quickly in a matter of days, let alone weeks and months. So, I'm happy. When is it going to play out? When do you think we've got, all the bad news? We know about the bad news. We've got inflation. Central banks are now sort of addressing it. When does this cycle, this tightening cycle, ease up? When does people start worrying it a little bit? When do you think the market will start to look a bit more buoyant? It's a $9 trillion question there, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, to put it too brutal, I mean, I always view it as a sort of market of stocks rather than a stock market itself, et cetera. So it's on a case-by-case basis for each particular firm. But overall sentiment, I think you're going to see basically multiple compression continue myself, simply because I think interest rates are going up. Inflation isn't going to sort of soften off that quickly. It's actually going to get worse before it gets better. I think the Bank of England was saying it's going to hit 7% in April when the energy prices go up. So, and then it's going to sort of tail down. And then it really depends on what that means in terms of GDP and the economics and how hard on the brake the central banks and the governments want to tax people to be able to get that balance between reducing inflation and, basically replenishing all the money that they've obviously spent on COVID over the last 2 years. So I would just say, investors shouldn't expect any more sort of get out of jail free cards. They should really sort of look at it such that this is going to be a more normal economic environment. We've had unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus over the last 2 years. We've had people at home saving money, so you've got this big saving. So getting to the answer to that is I actually don't think we're going to get back to where we were in terms of this effectively monetary, sugar rush that the economies have been really sort of drinking for or eating for the last sort of 2 years. So it's going to become a more normal environment, which is going to lead to overall multiple compression. How much it goes down depends how high sort of US bonds and 10-year gilts go. My instinct is saying they're going to check out around about sort of 2.5-3%. If that's the case, then we're probably looking at sort of GDP of about 2%, et cetera. And in that world, you expect the S&P and, to be on sort of 17, 18 times compared to 20 times at the moment. And then likewise with the FTSE, I mean, the oil companies and the banks, et cetera, will do okay, but they've probably seen most of the juice already in it. So I don't want to be a doomsayer because I don't think that it's going down, but you're going to have continued, good earnings potential, but that's going to be effectively offset by multiple compression so you probably find it, the stock markets go sideways. I think the stock markets could go sideways for the next year to 2 years, to be brutal. But it doesn't mean your stocks that you select.
And
that's what it comes down to.
Well, exactly.
I think it's going to be hard going, basically. A bit of a sledge job.
I think it comes back to, like I said, we discussed before, it's a stock pickers market. Yeah. Now, before, like I said, if you'd gone back to April 2020, you could have picked any stock and done very well. If you joined the market there, outsized returns. Now you've got to be careful. I mean, we're going to have a rebalancing here and it's going to consolidate a little bit and go sideways.
And I still think there's plenty of gas to come out some of these bubbles. Do you believe in crypto, for instance? And the answer to that is if you do, then it's got plenty of sort of opportunity there.
In November, I did a video saying, I just think now it's getting ridiculous, crypto. I mean, some of the stories around it, it's just stupid. It's okay if you want to trade it for liquidity and all that stuff. But I mean, there's not one person can give a decent valuation on any cryptocurrency, any token, I wouldn't mind if they're cheap and they're next to nothing, but they're way above where internet companies were back in the dot-com bubble, you know, their valuation. And at least they had businesses. These kind of things don't. They're like, a lot of them just, you know, trading tokens. So it is nuts. I think that they'll have to debase. I think they'll have to, you know, I think we'll see a collapse there, and then there'll be opportunities.
Well, what was quite interesting, and this is something that obviously, you know, investors at top level should be sort of like watching, is that it isn't so much the, you know, the interest rates fine is going to, you know, sort of like curtail or dampen down potential inflation. It's if the central banks start reducing the size of their balance sheets. And what that means, and that sounds like a whole bunch of jargon, but essentially it's about 40 billion or odd worldwide, which is basically been printing money. 40 trillion, not billion, 40 trillion, a huge amount, over 10 times the size of the UK economy, supporting what's been happening over the last few years and the great financial crisis. And if they start actually reducing that, they'll be sucking liquidity out of the market. And the reason why that happens is that essentially they are selling bonds to bond investors, who then have to obviously sell other assets to buy those particular, you know, investment grade assets, etc. And that goes all the way through the chain, i.e. you start then seeing in junk yield, you then see money taken out, ATMs taken out the stock market. And that's why you get the, you could get, rather than it settling at 17, 18 times PE for the S&P, it could actually settle at 15 times if you're seeing balance sheet reduction. So you could get a much more severe multiple compression over on the whole market if they do that. Now, the central bankers know that, and they're not stupid.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I alerted you this last year to watch the flipping bonds. I know you gave me a lot of hardship for it. But actually, I would add now, those who have been educated to watch the sort of like, you know, yield on bonds, now keep your sort of antenna on sort of like what's happening with the central banks, what they're talking about in terms of effectively reducing the size of their balance sheet, because this is big. This is big beer.
No, it is massive. Whereas if you look at the especially in America, S&P, and Nasdaq, they're ridiculous. Like I said, they're a chart on steroids. You could see, you know, after the sell off in 2020, they just went nearly vertical. I mean, if you zoom out a little bit compared to previous, you know, if you go back and scroll back the last say 30 years, it's been a nice gradual, you know, incline, and then all of a sudden it just dipped down and went up pretty much. So that's unsustainable. It needs to come out, and maybe that liquidity being sucked out of the market will do that. I think it will do that. But the one thing I think, you know, Powell and all that, they're very scared they're worried about scaring the markets, firstly. But secondly, there's a lot more debt around, isn't there? So a lot more companies will be hurt by, you know, interest rates going too high, and central banks as well, of course. I mean, so they've got to tread very carefully, I suppose. They can't overstep it. So I see why they're being cautious, but part of me thought they could have just upped it by 25 basis points that last meeting. Just get it done, you know, do something, rather than just messing around with the edges and talking.
I mean, let's put the issue in terms of they've got to be careful they don't damage the economy. Okay, let's just assume they don't. Yeah. Well, what they're doing, they don't damage the economy and companies, and they continue to trade pretty much okay, in line with sort of like, you know, trend economics, etc. Sucking liquidity out the market. Yeah. What you're doing, let me be clear about it. What you're doing is taking money from one pot that investors have. You're a big institution, but you're somebody like BlackRock, right? Mm. You're managing 10 trillion quid, okay? You then are faced with sort of like, currently you have eight trillion in equities or high yield debt. You're then shifting 25% of that to say 2 trillion into the high, effectively government bond market. Yeah, into US Treasuries. You have to sell 2 trillion.
Yeah,
you know, of assets elsewhere. So that shows you what sucking liquidity does to multiples. It forces institutions, and then has the knock-on effect, to sell the assets they currently have.
Is that happening already, though? Or no?
Yeah, well, it's not hugely, because they haven't started reducing the balance sheet. But that's why I'm alerting people.
Yeah.
Balance sheet selling and runoff is absolutely critical to multiple compression. We've seen multiple expansion over the last 2 years. You could get it that actually the economy does fine, but you've just got forced compression because of what the central banks are doing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're already at 9 trillion, the Fed. They can inflate their way out of that. listen, we're going to go. Paul, thanks for that, fella, and we'll
take care.
In a couple of weeks. Cheers, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.